Obviously, the parts of the Bloom taxonomy that I'm most interested in you paying attention to are the affective and the psychomotor domains, because they're the ones that have been beaten into you the least. I mean, almost everybody who has ever taught anything has seen some version of the cognitive domain and acts like it. At a minimum, what you see is a distinction between rote and applied. It's hard to pick up a test bank that doesn't sort items into rote and applied. And so that's a little chicken, but a beginning. And so what do you think about the cognitive domain? Should we accept as part of our responsibility getting them to care about the content of a course that they signed up for?
We shouldn't.
And there's one of the rules that I was taught by my first teaching instructor. He said, anytime you say to yourself, I shouldn't have to, do it twice. Do it in writing, then bring it up in class, and then send them home with a handout. This is back in the days when handouts were expensive procedurally, because you had to actually make a mimeograph master and go over and do this and get high, which was the good part. To do this, because for some reason I've always taught in places, back when we were using the mimeograph was always in a small closed room. You're pouring ether into this machine to make it work. Then you close the door behind you. I've had a couple different people suggest that that's where my teaching style comes from. You were high on ether the first 5 years you taught. No, I'm like this all the time. Okay, now, what if it's not a course that they signed up for? What if it's stats? Hey, bud, what if it's stats? It's not the first thing on most people's list. They can't often even understand why they have to take a stats or a methods course. They want to be a psychologist. They want to help people. In that situation, what do you do? Do you try and sell them on it and engage them? Or do you let them dodder along and fail through lack of interest and commitment? What do you think?
Sell it.
God provide incentives. It's less selling it, more you have to find the right way to sell it, I think.
Okay.
So you have to figure out what the students care about and try to incentivize the learning about that.
Okay.
Like, you really care about this, well, then you better know this, because otherwise you're going to suck at it.
Good. Good. What else can you do? In many departments, a certain requirement in the stats or the methods course is set, and unless you reach that, you can't take the senior level courses. When I was at Arlington, we had about a third of the 400 level courses were not available unless you had an A or a B in the stats class. You only needed a C to complete the requirements for the major. But to get into certain classes where the profs wanted to be able to talk about the results of studies, you had to have an A or a B in the stats class. And you had to have an A or a B in the methods class. And one of the things that was interesting is that some people who taught the stats class didn't even tell them that. Which leads to the general question, which is all about affect. What are you responsible for and what are you not responsible for in these children's lives? This question is going to come up a lot later today when we talk about policies. Because one of the basic things you've got to do is, where am I on that continuum from I have a responsibility for everything to I have a responsibility only to deliver 50 minutes of show and write a test? And you don't have to be in the same place in that continuum in all the decisions that you make. And when you're trying to decide where you are on those continuums, you better take out that wannabe sheet and make sure the decisions you're making are consistent. Or maybe look at them and go, do I want to be that kind of asshole? Because we're all going to be some kind of asshole. Okay? Nobody's going to be happy with everything that we do. We will never be sufficient in our skills or our investment for everybody. I've had people put on 350 assignments. There's not enough opportunity to practice the material. The minimum number of items to complete the pink things, if you get everyone right, the minimum number of items to get through that process is right around 1,400 to 1,500, depending upon what I have up my butt that semester. That was, for a person, insufficient practice. I didn't care enough about them and their future to give them an opportunity to interact with the material. Funny part was, the person was so unhappy with me that they signed the course eval, which allowed me to go back and look, and they had done two of the exercises. Clearly my fault somehow. But the question is, you know, what are you responsible for? A hand on the shoulder? A foot in the ass? What? Start talking. What do you think?
So, do you treat, maybe this is rhetoric, but you treat undergrads differently than graduates?
Do I? No.
No?
No.
You let them have incomplete like for 3 years?
Yeah, I didn't know what dimension you were picking. No. But I'm more likely to give somebody that I think I could get more performance out of later an incomplete than anyone I know.
Okay, even if it's an undergrad.
Yeah, but it's graduate students, I am fundamentally interested in them creating a world in which they reinforce and punish themselves learning how to schedule things, but I don't want that to get in the way of learning this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so if I have to wait, I'll wait. Well, you know, grow up, I'll wait. Undergraduates, no, just because I cannot do 165 at a time what I can do 30 at a time.
Okay.
Part of that's just I run out of me. I will tell you, though, and this is something we might talk about more in the policy, is that, you know, if a kid comes up to me and wants more time to do something, undergraduates, the research methods course, the 165-minute time, if one of them wants to, I'm behind, da-da-da-da-da, can I get my pink things done over the weekend? The answer is always yes, because I would rather have them learn it late than not learn it at all. Late to me is just trying to get them on a schedule, and part of that's for my own benefit. If I don't have them scheduled, at least some. At least 120 of the 160 aren't on some sort of schedule, I run out of semester. On the other hand, if they want more time to finish a lab assignment, no. Really hard no. Because I hold to a strict schedule in lab because the TAs are students too. And the TAs, this is all my version of things. This is not reality. This is my version of things. I have a responsibility to my TAs to create a schedule within which they can create theirs. And so I don't want even two kids turning in that paper 3 days late so that they either have to grade at two different times or put all the grading off or in any way change their already sort of busy graduate schedule around somebody who couldn't get their shit together. Now, if I am impressed with why they want to be late, I'll tell them yes and I'll grade it myself. But that's a fairly high threshold. There's got to be a really, really good reason. Now, part of my problem is I can tell you a couple of stories. I'm about to tell you a story, which is why I'm such a wuss about incompletes. We had a kid crushed the first test, the second test, and sort of fell off the planet. The third test isn't actually a test. It's all work materials. Somebody else has been through hell. And they sort of fell off in three and then didn't show up at all in four, and their lab work was always there, but just crap. So they end up with a solid D. You need a C to graduate with a psych major. You need a C in 350. So I pull the kid in, a box and a half of Kleenex later. Their life is reasonable. It has fallen apart. They're right. Their life has fallen apart. There's virtually nothing they could have done. And so I tell the kid, you're not getting a D. You're getting an incomplete. I want to see you and looked at the schedule. Said, I need you to start showing up here so we can catch up on stuff in class and lab. All of this is fine. You will not redo it. I know that you know this stuff. I know you can do these things. We start here. Kid showed up, missed 3 points the rest of the semester. 3 points. Anywhere. Deeply committed to it. Rescheduled herself around it. Went on to take 450, 451, 941, 942, 943, 6 credits of this. And 2 years ago, she got tenure at a prestigious quantitative program. I give that kid a D. With me?
Mm-hmm.
And so I hate missing opportunities for people to max out because of the schedule. But the TA's lives are more important to me than even that most of the time. Now, I can tell that story, but don't ask me to defend it. It is an almost unreasonable set of policies that I have. And in combination, they only make sense to the people who are desperately looking for more time. They love it. Other people go, well, I didn't get to do that because, you know, there'll be two kids standing in line. And the first one says, can I have an extra time to do this? And I say, yes, I need it in my email by done. Second person, I say, no, you haven't done anything on time all semester. I need you to get this done. Okay. And they get it done. And typically, they square up after that for the rest of the semester. So, you know, 30 years later, I pretend that I can make those decisions to the best advantage of the child, and I do it as if I could. I told you I was going to tell you shit. So, what responsibility do we have for the affect of the kid?
We have to care about them, and we have to be able to communicate to them that we care about them.
Okay.
So
you're now way out on one end of a continuum that would scare the shit out of some people merely because of the energy, let alone the responsibility.
But that's part of the job, right?
I think so.
I mean, whether they don't want to take stats because they're not interested in it or
right.
they're intimidated by it,
right.
if they have someone who they are told they're supposed to look up to and respect and all that, telling them, I know you can do it, I believe in you, you know, we're going to practice this, or I'm going to give you feedback so you can get it right next time. I think, at least for most students, that's a big incentive to care.
Mm-hmm. Because they are psych majors. They are people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I've been told that a lot of the stuff that works really well for me sucks over to business college. They don't care.
They just want to get a job.
They want to get a job. And
it's all practical. That practical side of things.
She's a business. But she came to it late, so you can't completely be trusted.
Yeah. Studies person, so.
Yeah, turned into a business person. So your opinion of business people may be a little light.
Yeah, I worked in a public school system for a long time, and there's a saying that kids won't care what you know until they know how much you care.
I have no problem with that.
And I believe that they won't care how much you know until they know how much you care. If they know,
in other words, your expertise is bought in part by your caring.
Yeah, they'll put more stake in what you have to say, your opinion. And then when you tell them why they should care,
mm-hmm.
they're more likely to believe you. I think. That's my
opinion. You can all, and I will stop saying in my opinion. Obviously, none of this is foolish enough to think that we're stating fact.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get beyond about 2 plus 2, most of teaching is based on an opinion, or at best, a theory. So how far are you willing to go?
What do you mean?
Well, how hard are you willing to work to convince somebody that it's in their best interest to crush this course that they don't give a shit about?
And so much time you have.
Okay.
Is at least a major factor.
Okay.
You can't dedicate time to every single student, especially in a class like that.
All right. So how do you do it in mass?
Have them teach themselves.
Say what?
Make them teach themselves, each other.
Okay, why would that make them think that you
love
them?
I don't actually think that will work.
Okay.
Easy way out. It's so. Like watching.
Okay, let's start somewhere. Not the end point, but the starting point. How did I do it in our classes? What did I do to try and get you to give a shit? Because I had it easy with you. You know. You've all heard the stories about graduate stats classes. Oh my God, if I don't do well in this, they're going to shoot me. They won't even send me off. They'll just shoot me and hide the body. So what did we do?
I think you emphasized a lot that, or maybe you didn't, this is what I got from it, that, I mean, it's going to matter that we learn and retain this information. So it's not just succeeding in the class, but we need to know this for what is going to benefit us, which is it's going to benefit our research, or is graduate school going to be easier, or whatnot. So that's our incentive. Mm-hmm. And for undergrads, I feel like their incentive is going to be much more variable than ours is, because we're here.
It's more variable, but that's still useful. But you're exactly right. And part of the thing that I did is I sold it so much that selling it didn't even seem like a thing. Every time we talked about something, there was some story or some something about why it matters to know this. And you're right, the other graduates were variable. But most graduate students, and we're really lucky here, because we have this thing called Psych 100, which is basically how to be a productive psych major, and they are selling them on research participation from the beginning. You want to get into somebody's lab, and you want to be doing stuff, not just sitting in classes. Okay? That makes it easier for me to sell, because this is the first course that all of my colleagues ask if they have had. Oh, you want to come work in my lab? If you had 350, what did you get? And I can just tell them, that's the first question you're going to hear. Oh, shit. Okay. better not suck, huh? And so I agree with you completely, but that's something that's worth not passing up. Because you've got enough people that have been educated enough as to what they're going to do with the major by the time they get to you as a sophomore or a junior, that you can use that as leverage. Use what they want to do after as leverage to do well at this. So what are some of the other variabilities that you're fretting about?
For classes I've taught, students who are going on to med school or grad school or PA school or nursing school, like, this is relevant to them in some sense. But kids who are just getting the degree and they don't plan to really, they don't buy into how psychology itself is going to benefit mm-hmm. their job after, they don't want to do anything with it. To them, that's who I've struggled trying to incentivize of how this information is important.
I agree. So what do you try?
For them, I've just tried to make the class fun, and this isn't stat specific,
but no, that's
make,
okay. mm-hmm.
make the class enjoyable, where, I mean, if they don't...
Remember, enjoyable and fun aren't quite the same.
To me, they've been the same.
Okay.
So if they don't really care so much about the content, at least they care enough to want to do well for me. So mm-hmm. I think if you try to build that trust, and as you said, if you show them that you care, then... If nothing else, they don't want to disappoint you.
Yep.
They don't want to make your life harder. But
when it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and they can decide between getting high and finishing their homework, if they don't like you, or they're pissed at you, and they don't think there's any hope, why put in that extra hour?
Yeah.
I think you're nailing it. Well, one of the ways that I try and sell it to everybody is... real simple, because I like to start, remember how inductive inference works. You start somewhere that everybody goes, yeah, fuck me, that's true. And then you try and build on. So, can you learn everything you need to know when you're getting your degree? And even the dimmest one in there goes, well, no. All right, cool. That means that you're going to need more knowledge later than you're going to have. Yeah. You've only got two choices. You've got to be able to evaluate information and decide if it's useful. And sometimes you might have to generate your own information. And I said, that is what we're doing in here. If somebody hands you an article and says, I think we should change the way we run our production line based on this thing that I read in a trade magazine,
Might it be a great idea? Might it be total bullshit? Do you think you can tell the difference? If you apply the stuff from this class, you'll probably be able to tell the difference. And one of the things that everybody who has any job anywhere is usually is asked at least once in a while is, what have you done for me lately? What have you done that you should get a raise? What has your section done that we shouldn't fire you all and send you off and save money? People have to, you have to generate information. That's the other half of this class. And they see research methods as part of psychology instead of seeing research methods as part of evaluating and generating information. And when you can get them to do that, like commercials, how are you going to show your mom that it's okay if you be allowed to go to Daytona? What are you going to try and do and convince her? Especially when she read this article that 90% of the kids who go there smoke dope. What are you going to do? You are in an information battle all of your life. You're not going to have all the information you need. You just told me that. So how are you going to decide what information to accept and how are you going to generate information? That's what we're doing here. And that's not the way they think of it. But if I can get them to think about it that way, I say, oh, maybe this won't suck. Well, it's still going to suck. Maybe it'll be useful. So how do you do that?
So do you explicitly tell the students that like the lessons you're learning in this class are not content specific, or do you embed that type of learning into the lectures or the materials or the exercises? Or
both. I don't expect them to catch much that's subtle, even deeply repeated. I will tell them something and then try to show them on multiple occasions without telling them that that's what I'm showing. I'm trying to have it both ways. That's where applied research is great. You know, I like to bring in studies that they've already heard about or maybe think they know all about. Say, okay, how did they get this information? And now that you know how they got this information, do you trust that information more or less? Wouldn't it have been cool if somebody had told you, when they told you all about Kitty Genevieve, is that her name? The famous case in New York of the woman who was butchered on the streets and no one tried to help her? What if they had told you that the definition for helping was a minimum of 90 seconds of physical contact with the person? And anything that other than that was not considered a helping behavior? What if somebody had told you what that operational definition was? When they say, nobody helped her. Because there were, in fact, dozens of people who did all sorts of things, none of which qualified as helping behavior. Oh, shit. What if they, when they tell you the study about the cabbies who would not pick up black customers in certain sections of the city? Clear racism. What if they had told you that 60% of the cabbies in that study were black? Oh, shit. Sampling matters. What if you had learned, and you know, you don't all use examples that piss them off, but the idea is to have stories where, now that you know something about where the data came from, do you feel more comfortable with the conclusions or less? And what I'm trying to do is make them thirsty for having the right information to decide how they feel about that information. Commercials are great, but I show them, you know, I show them a lot more than I show you guys, because we've got more content. But I show them a lot of examples that are all hyping on how important is operational definition, how important is sampling, how important is confound control. If I can get people to lust after information about those three things when they're deciding whether to believe a piece of information or generate a piece of information, I am successful beyond my wildest dreams. Sampling, operational definitions, and confound control. Then we move on to really sexy stuff like conditional effects and unique information, all of which is much easier to teach if they get those first three. What's the one I love to show? I might have shown it to you. Where this sheriff was pummeled because the number of violent crimes had doubled under the 4 years that he was sheriff. It's a lie. The reason the thing had happened is that they redefined a violent crime to include burglary. Burglary had never been a violent crime before. Burglary is over half of all crime in most precincts. And so if you call that a violent crime, suddenly this guy's got way more violent crime than any of the people before them ever had. It's bullshit. It's an operational definition screw-up. Used as evidence. But that one, boy, they sort of... Do people do shit like that? Yes. And it's easy. I just used his data from before and the current data. You can't expect me to go back and change his data just so it conforms to the operational definition I used with mine. Yes, I should. Apples to apples, oranges to oranges. So it sounds like you think that you ought to bend them to your will. Remember what I said, I don't think there's anything more manipulative than teaching, except parenting. Parents in a room? Alright, so.
But with teaching, I'm sure you don't feel so sad when you make them learn a lesson, right?
I don't feel sad.
No?
In general, if I think somebody has accomplished something that's going to change their life, what I'm willing to do to them to get there, we shouldn't talk about. All right, so what we're talking about here is caring about content, and whenever I say content, I also mean skills and abilities and attitudes about things. All right, so the way that I find useful to think about this is to ask, what do they care about? What don't they care about? And how much of this is it in our best interest to change the category it belongs in? And one way to think about this that I like is, what do they expect out of a course? Okay? What do they expect out of a course? And so there's going to be parts of the course they expect and value. And just to make it really simple, partly for me, let's talk about teaching abnormal psychology. It's a great example. It's really fun to hang out with people who teach abnormal psychology, because that group, more than any other group I know, has worked through this. Developmental psychologists are also kind of like that. All right, so they have some topics that they know and expect and value. Why do most kids take abnormal psychology? Why did you take abnormal psychology when you took it as an undergraduate?
Sounds fun.
Sounds fun. Why is it fun?
Because it's weird.
Yeah, wackos. Yeah. Okay? Which we'll call diagnostic categories. That's going to be part of the course. They're right. That's going to be part of the course. Okay? Now, is a complete treatment of diagnostic categories going to be more or less than they think it is? So there's going to be depth that you're going to have to sell. Not just these categories, but if you're going to understand it, and this is based on looking at the chapters that teach diagnostic categories. There's more stuff in there than the diagnostic categories. They spend talking about psychological testing. They spend time talking about interviewing strategies. They spend time talking about the developmental aspects of these things. They spend time talking about the history of diagnoses, all of which are greater depth than they planned on. Well, you guys know most of the either-ors in the world. If starting from the topics that they know are going to be part of the course, for all of those courses we're likely to have to add depth, what's the other thing we're likely to have to talk them into? Depth and breadth. Which is?
It's not too easy to answer.
Which is topics that they don't know are part of an intro course, or part of an abnormal course. From the first day of an abnormal course, and I've had people who were nice enough to do this for me, you have them write down what they think the chapters in their text are. They tend to get about 3 out of 14. And if you have them rate, and then if you put them up there and you have them rate the apparent importance of them, most of the ones that they didn't label, that's not cool. That's not abnormal psychology. Why are we studying that? I don't give a shit about that. I don't hear about crazies. And so this gives us a bit of a structure for thinking about what's the content we have to get them to care about. I think it's always helpful with any audience, whether it's a workshop or a class or anything else, even writing a research article. I think that this is a useful way to structure what you're going to present to them. What do they expect? What do they think is coming? What do they think this is going to be about? What are the parts of it that they're right? These are important things, but they don't know all the parts that are important, and what are the things that they do not realize is part of this discussion. I start almost every workshop I do with the wannabe exercise, because I think it's that central to being consistent and building towards being the teacher that you give a shit about. Sometimes the title of my workshop makes it pretty clear that's reasonable. He's talking about impression management. That makes sense. That's kind of in the title. Other times, it has nothing to do with what they've brought me in to workshop on. But I got to sell it a little more. Wait, I thought we were going to talk about testing. We are going to talk about testing. But we're going to talk about being the tester that you want to be. We have to embed that in the context of the teacher that you want to be. So I know this isn't in the title, but can I have 15 minutes for you to think about this? And then we'll spend the next couple of hours realizing why I asked you to spend the 15 minutes. You just start with a trust me. So I think that this is a useful structure to approach things. And you can decide whether you're going to think of this using the cognitive domain or the affective domain. Is this things they're going to learn about? Or is this things they're going to learn to care about? Following the thing that both of you have said like 6 times now, are dressed in red group and back, it's easier to work hard at things that you care about. Okay. Is anybody struggling with the notion that there's how-tos to learn in a stats and methods class? Typically, it's the easiest course. People go, oh, yeah, they have to actually do shit, not just learn about stuff. It's often a little harder, not really hard, but a little harder to figure out, well, what are the things that they do in other classes? Okay, what is a developmental how-to in great example of that is you have two kids, you give two different descriptions of what kids can do when they're five. You ask them to anticipate what the differences will be when they're seven or nine. That's a performance assessment of understanding. It's very how-to-y as opposed to about-y. I tend to put Y's in the end. But there's no real struggle getting people to realize that there's some stuff they're going to have to be, they're going to be expected to be able to do at the end of a methods class. So then the question becomes, what? Let's take Pearson's product model correlation. Should they be able to articulate the defining mathematical formula? Should they be able to follow a hand calculation? And if so, should they be able to do a hand calculation with both the computational formulas or with both the defining formulas and the computational formulas? For those of you who have forgotten, the defining formula of a correlation is you convert everything to a z-score. Take the product of the z-scores, add those up, divide by n. That's the defining definition, or defining formula of an R. That process requires an awful lot of squaring and square rooting and dividing, which are the things that increase computational error. So all of the stuff that you and I are used to, sum of x, y minus sum of x times sum of y, blah, 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 as the computational formulas are all designed to reduce computational error and make it faster to do the computation. So it was important that they be able to do the computation both ways, or are neither interesting. Should they be able to start with, should they be able to look at output from SPSS? Should they be able to start with an SPSS data set and get a correlation? Should they be able to start with data on a paper and build the data set and do the correlation? There's a whole bunch of stuff in there that are different versions of, well, they ought to be able to do a correlation. Right? And you got to decide what's worth the time. Because that's our biggest problem. You've said it a couple times. You just freaking run out of time. I mean, like a whole bunch of shit. If I had my way, 350 would be a year long. And I wouldn't change anything. We would just do a little deeper on everything. There's almost no topical anything that I'd like to include. I've got a very nice Excel program that I never freaking get to use, which is you go to different pages and it has different versions of a 7-variable path model. You know, starts with 1 versus starts, just how the boxes are arranged. And when I've used it, it's people get a feel for that. And it's real easy to do because they don't have to do any of the math. They just box it up, plug the correlation matrix in, push a button, it puts the beta weights up, and then they interpret it. And the other thing that it does is it shows them the same thing as a regression model. And there's a whole bunch of questions about what did you learn from one that you didn't learn from the other. Here's the correlations, and that thing rocks. And I don't have time for it. Because I've chosen to do something else instead. So it's always a question of how much time do you have. Don't even say that anymore. Within your time constraints, both within and across topics, what is so important that it's going to be part of that first, maybe only stats class they ever have? So let's talk about hand computations. How important are hand computations? Okay, so here's the way to ask that question. For whom might the hand computations be beneficial?
Someone going on in statistics.
Someone going on in statistics. How many of those will be in each group of 150? 1 in 3. We produce about one. We produce about one person who goes on to study mathematical statistics within their discipline every year and a half.
30% is quite a bit. 30%. You say
30%? No. 1 in 3? 1 in 3 semesters.
Oh, I thought from your group, 1 in 3.
No. 1 in 3 semesters.
Oh, okay.
Not 1 in 3 kids.
I thought 1 in 3 kids. Like, that's good.
So out of our current batch of about 900 psych majors, I expect to find two or three who will study mathematical statistics as a necessary part of their future. So they're going to get it some other way.
Yeah.
When I was you, we were being taught that you needed about 20 reps of ANOVA to figure out how ANOVA works. Hand calculations. Okay? That offended me when I was teaching stats, because I didn't have time to give them 20 reps, and I wasn't good enough to keep them enthusiastic for 20 reps. Although I'll show you a couple of shortcuts. One of the things we'll talk about is generating data sets that are very easy to calculate on because they have whole number means and standard deviations. So the sum squares are whole numbers. Just that really helps. And so, offended by this, I decided that I wanted to figure out what I could do instead. And so what I figured out how to do is a series of questions to ask them at each computational step. So to calculate the mean, to calculate the other mean. Are these really close together or really far apart? Based on that, do you think we're going to find a significant difference or not? Calculate the standard deviations. You may remember from lecture, right there on the handout, you might remember from the lecture that the F looks both at the variation between and the variation within. Now that you know what the mean difference is, look at how much variation there is within each group, and are those groups close together or far apart relative to that variation? Answer. Now calculate your between group sum of squares, your within group sum of squares, and make your T. Now go do the next set. Do the means and the standard deviations with the same questions. One of them had a big mean, or substantial mean difference and little tiny standard deviations. The other had about the same mean difference and big standard deviations. So then we got to the mean and standard deviation. On this one, they go, yeah, it looked pretty good. Probably not. Now, let's look at how the total variance got divided into between and within. Notice that in this has bigger total variation. Mean difference is about the same, but the max and min are a little bit different. And we was able to make a thing so that two or three passes through that, which was four or six Fs, and my kids were crushing the test that they had used as an assessment test. I didn't even make up my own test of how much they learned about ANOVA. I took the one that they had published with, because that way I don't have to fight with them about operational definitions. If I can kick their ass on their test, they have to take it. Right? If I make my own test, then we argue about the test. I'm smarter than that. So we were able to show that with this guided performance, we could get performance that was better than they got in 20 reps. Do I hear a no shit, brothers and sisters? Right? Here, I told you some stuff once. Let's see how long it takes it to internalize. Forever. Let's remind you of what those things are at every possible opportunity, even when you're a little bit bored with it, and then we make you do it again. And what happens? Reps. And the right things are being repped. The one part of that that sucked is I did not get the reduction in math concern that they had gotten from 20 reps. Because after about 10 or 12 reps, most people make no more math mistakes. They have figured out every way that they can fuck up summing, squaring, subtracting, and they just don't anymore. But that takes like 10 or 12. And if I'm getting the core content in 6, they're still a little bit more math anxious and a little bit more math error. But they know how goddamn F works. See the trade-off? Well, that wasn't enough. Then the question was, if I can pass that on, can I just plain teach it? Because this was, you know, middle 80s. Discovery learning was the world. Okay? No teacher worth his salt told anybody anything. We allow you to discover. At about 1/15th the pace. Talk about running out of time. Okay, if you have to invent the calculus, it's going to go slowly. Okay? So the question was, can I instruct it without any reps? Damn near. And you guys have had that lecture. You've had that lecture three times. Once when we talked about F, once when we talked about understanding how confounds influence results, and once when we talk about how statistical control and COBA influence results. You might not have had all of them yet. But that same lecture shows up, I think it's five times, between 941, 942, and certain modules. Okay? So now, how important is doing things by hand if I can instruct to a high level of understanding of that concept? Not as much. Because they've gotten what I want out of it another way. Does that make sense? Alright. I still make them do stuff by hand. I don't make the graduate students do stuff by hand because my best reason for why I want the undergraduates to do stuff by hand isn't true for graduate students. Undergraduate students may still end up in a class where being able to do something by hand makes them look good or allows them to learn that material. Not so much in our department, but over in biology and over some in business and sociology and comm studies, in all of those classes, most of those kids at some point have to do mean standard deviations, correlation, and t-test by hand. And if our kids fly, if the post-350 kids fly through that, they're spending their time on the content-y parts of the analysis instead of, I don't know. Make sense? So I still make them do it. But at this point, I'm trying to make sure that they can follow a set of formulas. So I do everything that I can to minimize the time expenditure for that particular accomplishment. We use my handout, which is tuned to my homework. The steps are in the same order. And I haven't done anything weird. They can take that, pick up any set of data, and a correlation will appear as if by magic. Okay? But I've got them tuned. And they have a thing where they can check their answer at each stage. And they can redo it. And so the usual performance on that is 98% in the people that are getting A's, B's, and C's. And about 12% on the people getting D's and E's. And that 12% is a mix of people who don't do it and suck at it and don't care. Pains me. Pains me. You can't save everybody. Some people are absolutely deeply committed to doing badly in the stats class. Somehow it shows you, or somehow it shows the world. I don't understand it. I've tried to talk to people who are like that. And just, oh, you don't understand. You're right. Explain it to me. This course sucks so bad. It is so meaningless that the only thing to do is flunk it.
I'm afraid of it.
Yeah.
No one will have anything to do with it. And it's the first thing they said to my committee, get a statistician. And I'm like, okay, but no one understands it with nutrition.
Yes.
So no one understands, you know, the two together. And
the nutrition people are plenty smart enough. Send your friends, man.
I know.
Don't take this wrong. But you are not from the top of the intellectual pile among nutritionists.
No.
You're doing great. But I know I have been on a bunch of committees at different times. None of those people are stupid.
No, they're not.
But they're being allowed to avoid a knowledge base.
Well, we take 859 and 860 is what's required.
Yeah.
And that's all the hand calculations. But without the little checkpoints, I think that's a great idea.
And with no methodology.
Right.
No understanding of where the data come from and why that might matter.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you spend 8 hours on a problem, and you might not have the right answer in the end, and you don't know why.
859 has not changed content since when it was 459, from when it was, are you ready for this, 172.
So 859 from where, from MedSci? That's the one you're talking about?
It's the same course as 459, because sometimes they were taught together, and years and years and years ago it was 172. It was a freshman course.
So...
Now it's a master's course.
Now it's a master's course,
The only fear I have about...
You're lying.
What?
As if you only had one.
Well, about this
topic. At this moment.
Right. What I'm going to fret about right now. Yeah.
So you give them kind of a, like, these instructions to follow to be able to calculate.
I'm putting them in the simplest possible world, yes.
Doesn't need...
Yes, keep going.
So I do like the idea of the discovery mm-hmm. in the parenting, for instance, mm-hmm. right? Because they make the connection.
But they're led to it instead of, hey, look, I remember three analyses ago that the sums of squares was about the same total and broke differently into between and within, and I got a different F. Nobody thinks of that because they're just trying to get through the fucking math. Every time, they're just trying to get through the math. So instead I say, now stop, go back and look at the last one. Write down total sums of squares, between sums of squares, within group sums of squares, F. Write it down for both. What's the same? What's different? Why do you think they're different?
So
oh,
you
shit.
Help them make the connection.
Yeah.
But you want them to make the connection.
Yes.
Anyways.
Because that was discovery learn.
Yes, yes. That's
okay?
The thing.
There's discovery, there's learning. There's discovery from learning and learning from discovery. Back then, this was the language they used. And the learning from discovery is when you just have them rep until they get it. Okay, basically it's Groundhog Day. Statistics course done is Groundhog Day. You're going to keep doing it until you get it right. It's hardcore black box behaviorism. I'm not going to tell you what the rules are, but I'll reward you when you finally come up with it.
So you, okay.
Okay? What I did was much more like a Christmas carol. Three ghosts will be visiting you. Tell you how you are fucking up your life and remind you that if you don't square this up, you're going to die. That's my instructional style. I am much more a Scrooged and much less a Groundhog Day. Treating Bill Murray as the ultimate teacher. So, yeah, but
because I'm worried about how well they internalize the process.
As well as, okay, do you know how much of an introductory psych course is remembered on average 4 months later?
Zero. Minus 10.
It ranges between 14% and 40%, depending upon what topics. Different people operationalized it differently, and if you load up on the things that they probably learned in high school, they seem to retain that better because they're not actually retaining it. They already knew it. Mm-hmm. They didn't learn it here. So I can make that test look better or poorer. But you're right. You're right. But remember, that to me, that is an intermediate task. The task that I really want them to be good at, that I point everything else at, is the lab final, where you walk in there and there's a 2-page article to read, and there's a bunch of data and 6 hypotheses. 4 hypotheses. And you got to put those data into SPSS, you got to do a little recode, you got to do a little compute, then you got to pick the right stat, get the right answer, and answer the question. That's what I want.
Okay. And then they need to do it on their own.
That's right.
Okay.
And so everything that I'm doing with the hand calculations is intended to serve the using the computer package and having some understanding of what's going on so that if they are in a class later where somebody wants them to understand variance partitioning, it's not completely foreign. And I can tell you that... if people understand the between and within thing, even a little bit, for reasons that I cannot explain, they screw up no hypotheses as support for a hypothesis less. They screw up, these results don't support the hypothesis, because even those are significant, the result is in the backwards. There's two things, common mistakes that they don't seem to make. If I can get them better at something about how the statistic works. I've never really tracked that through, but it's there. So what's the point? The point is, when you're trying to decide how important something is, there's two things I would like you to look at. How important it is to perform with this material in the real world. And two, how important is it to know this to learn something else that's coming in this course. You're going to have a bazillion decisions to make about what you've got the time to teach and what you've done. Those are two things that I really want you to stop and think about. Do they need this for life? Do they need this for later in this course? And if I do decide they need it, I know ahead of time whether they think it's part of the course, it's added depth, or it's added breadth. That tells me how to sell it. Notice that we haven't talked at all about what's in the book as making a decision for whether to teach it or not. Okay? The reason I don't use a book, I would love to use a book, except they're $300 for an intro stats book. And they don't have cool stuff in it, and the stuff they do have in it, I can't bring myself to care about much of the time. Or I just don't like the way they cover it because they're all freaking same. It's scary how much homogeny there is. All right. Anything else that you want to talk about with respect to the taxonomy? I really tried to tell you why them caring and them doing are both really, really important. Or any other parts of that. So between now and Monday, read back through the Bloom's pages one more time and see if there's anything that you want to talk about or you want to hear a story about or whatever. All right, let's talk about class calls.
What did you put up there? Parts of course they expect and what?
Value, I think.
Oh, value. Yeah.
What am I doing?
Is that value?
Value.
That's value.
Okay.
Clearly.
Remember when you were all shy and polite and shit? Yeah, that's gone.
I mean, it looks like a really cool name for like a tech company or something like Vizlu.
Yeah, A's, S's, and G's strangely look alike. Turn down.